Hi, I'm Ted Price of Insomniac Games. On this episode of Game Maker's Notebook, I got to talk at length with one of my best friends in the industry, Brian Fleming. Brian's a co-founder and managing partner at Sucker Punch Games. And we've known each other for a couple decades, and we've been sharing ideas and advice since Sucker Punch was making Sly Cooper and Insomniac was making Ratchet for the PlayStation 2. Today, Brian goes into depth about their massive new game, Ghost of Tsushima, and some of the challenges they face making it. We talk about cultural authenticity. We talk at length about what it was like to create such a giant game. And Brian shares some great advice for up-and-coming developers. Please join me.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I will say I have absolutely loved playing the game. And I've had so much fun playing and just getting lost in a completely different world. I mean, and I will say too, that sentiment has been echoed over and over in fantastic reviews.
Yeah.
So congratulations on a spectacular game.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ted. It is, as you know, it's kind of a long, dark tunnel working on a game, and it's strange to then emerge and you go this dramatic change in your day-to-day work and your experience of work, because suddenly the thing that you've been working on really pretty quietly and pretty privately for a long time goes suddenly incredibly public. And it's enjoyable and stressful and rewarding. And it's been great. It's been a great couple of weeks.
Well, actually, you know, what were the couple of weeks before launch like for you?
You know, it's nerve-wracking because, you know, at this point, the games are big enough that you really have to circulate them through to the press even a little more than 2 weeks early, because the game is long enough and we wanted, you know, we believe that the game is kind of an immersive, meditative experience in some ways. We wanted people to have time to spend with the game. We didn't want the idea of like, hey, you've got 3 days to do your review. We wanted them to have like 2 weeks so that the press could have the same kind of experience that we thought was best for the game. So at that point, you've given the game out to the press and you're just nervous. You know, you're worried about how it's going to be received. There's nothing you can do at that point. You know, the missile has been launched and you're just waiting to see what happens. And then in very quick succession, you have the reviews hit and then the game goes live. And then you have the whole post-launch universe. Partially you're, you know, hopefully not too many bugs, but you're fixing a few bugs, adding a few little, you know, nice to have features or tweaks to the game. And you're sort of enjoying the reaction of the world community to the work you did. So it's a really strange and very distinctly different month, from the, you know, 6 years that preceded it, while you're working on the game.
6 years. Wow.
Yeah, it's a long process. It is a little winding road, and we'll tell some of those stories today, I bet. But
yeah,
you know, it's a long process. We finished First Light, you know, just about 6 years ago, and knew we wanted to make, you know, something of this scale, something grand, something transportive. And it took us a while to find that, and once we found it, it took us a long time to build it.
Well, did releasing the game in the middle of a pandemic make any difference for you?
Well, it made a ton of differences. And, you know, certainly we all went home in early March, and the game wasn't, you know, wasn't done certainly in early March, you know, and so we had to final the game from home. And I think, you know, Sucker Punch, a game like this, Sucker Punch is only a part of it, right? I mean, there certainly is the incredible work that our IT guys and really our whole team did, turning our company into a work for home company at the most critical, stressful part of the project. Certainly was not expected, but it worked out okay. And a credit to all the people who are associated with that. But again, that's just Sucker Punch, right? You have other far flung parts of the world that are involved. You know, we have localization, In Latin America and in Spain and Italy that were having really serious coronavirus issues. And all of that is all part Japan. All of that is all part of finishing the game. And so there were not, it's not just the story of Sucker Punch. It's the story of the worldwide localization effort and finding ways to record actors when they can't go into the studio, and it was, you know, super complicated suite of problems. And we really, on the last VO, on the last voiceovers, we didn't even have it when we went out to reviews. Some of those came in very, very close to launch, but to the credit of all involved, everything got recorded and mastered and integrated into the game in time for launch. So pretty fortunate.
It is quite the accomplishment. And I think it's easy for folks to forget just how much, you know, how complex it is to release a game in the first place, right?
Yeah, and every time it's getting worse, right? I mean, each one is pushing and testing you in new ways. So, you know, you had to sort of slow down a little bit and be really careful and focus on the critical things that needed to happen. We needed to figure out how to make sure that we'd created a pipeline and a timeline for all that localized audio to come in, and that we didn't crush the teams that were mastering all of that audio. You know, there's a lot to do after it gets recorded. And so you can't just have that all happen on the last day. It all has to, you know, it takes time. And so it was logistically pretty complicated set of things, but again, fortunately, by the time we got to our launch date, everything was ready to go. So it's a good story, but not an easy ending.
Probably not something that we all want to do over and over.
I told my management that if when we're going gold on our next major game and a worldwide pandemic breaks out, they got to find somebody else to do that one. It's a one-time deal for me.
I'm sure that's not really the case, but I do want to talk about you a little bit, because I think, you know, you've managed to fly under the radar a lot in terms of being out there, and because you're always focused on production. And I just would love for the listeners to understand more about your background, right? How you got into the industry. Do you mind just taking a couple minutes and describing that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I had an early start. When I was in high school, I was an Apple II sort of, you know, player and hacker, and taught myself programming on that box all the way to learning assembly language, and actually applied for and got a summer job while I was in high school working at Epix. You remember the summer games? So if you ever play California Games on the Apple II, two of those events, I was my first ship game. So this is you know, back in the late 80s. Then I went off to college. I got a degree in physics, which, you know, adds to the mystery, I guess, you know. And I worked at Microsoft after college for a number of years doing commercial software, you know, electronic mail, and did a little bit of work on Windows and a few other things. And then it was there that I met the founding partners of Sucker Punch, Chris Zimmerman, Bruce Oberg, and we went off and started Sucker Punch thereafter. So it was kind of a journey that's come in and out of games over, you know, a 20, 30 year period.
Was there a specific inspiration that moved you into starting Sucker Punch, a goal that you had?
The moment was actually pretty singular, now that you ask. There were two things that happened in the same period of time. The first was, and I forget exactly which order it was, but the first was the shipment of Mario 64, a game that had a really profound impact on me. It was the kind of game that I felt like, okay, that's something I could believe that I would change my career to go make that. Mm-hmm. That I really was affected by that. And of course, our first game, Rocket, is not wildly different from that. You can really feel that inspiration. But the second, equally important and different, was Abe's Odyssey was shipped. Mm-hmm. And so Abe's Odyssey was the first game that I remember feeling like I was unqualified to compete with, that it was so cinematic and so rich. The transitions between the unbelievable pre-rendered cutscenes and gameplay were so seamless that we did not have that skill set. We did not come from a background of film production, of really anything that would help us do that. And so we were terrified, candidly, of, hey, we'd always, you know, because Chris and Bruce and I, we'd always talked about this would be our thing. And when that game came out, it felt like, holy cow, we may be in trouble. We may not be able to compete with that. And the Nintendo 64, if you remember back then, had cartridges still.
Yeah.
And Abe's Odyssey was on the PlayStation, and it had a CD, which had a much larger capacity and allowed them to do it. So that's why we decided to go then and to target the N64, because we felt like the smaller cartridge form factor, the fact that you couldn't have, you know, an hour of pre-rendered movies on that cartridge, made it more favorable terrain for a bunch of folks like us, where we didn't have that movie making and cinematic background. And we figured we had to enter the market then and there, or we would be left behind. And so that was kind of the two things that that combined to make us go and decide to enter and start Sucker Punch and start on the N64.
That's awesome. I will say that I do remember having similar feelings about Abe's Odyssey, and
yeah,
and what a beautiful game that was.
And unbelievable work, Lauren and the team, you know, really inspiring for all of us, and created a sense of urgency.
Which is sometimes what we need, right? I mean, yep. We need that sort of that moment to push us over the, you know, to jump off the cliff.
Yeah.
And clearly you did that. So looking back from the beginning to today, what have been the biggest evolutionary moments for Sucker Punch?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that the most important single change was our first big game, which was Sly, you know, and everything before that we'd done on Rocket was, you know, sort of like getting our MBA and learning how to run a company and doing all that. And Sly, we were fortunate enough, you know, on the strength of some of the work we'd done, to end up in a, what we consider to be a pretty, you know, dreamlike situation. We were working with Sony first party, on a character platforming game, exactly what we wanted to make. And we had to actually be able to do that now. And, you know, it's sort of the dog that caught the car, you know, like, oh my God, we got it. We better be able to deliver. And we had, you know, we had never done, you know, that level of animation. You know, we had to, at that time, we'd never even done skinned characters, you know, so we had a long way to go to get Sly's tail to look soft and to do the quality animation. I think also it was really transformative because Sony had this rich history, in part written by you and your team, of making these great platforming games. And it really allowed Sony, Grady, and some of the people that I know you know and you work with to raise our eye lines to say, oh, you don't know how far you are from being ready to ship. You know, their ability, using focus testing, using the great support that the production teams there provide, they really helped us understand the scope of what we needed to accomplish and pushed us to reach those levels. And so, you know, that was the single most important project, that 18 month, whatever it was, window that we went from nothing to shipping Sly, maybe it was a couple years, but that was really important for the company. We really became, you know, a proper first party developer, I think, at that point. We made improvements, of course, along that series. And then the second was jumping into Infamous and deciding to do streaming games, big open world games, which was a huge stretch for us again. Also changed our art style a bunch, you know, brought a more, we had done all the Sly work and the Rocket work was all, you know, stylized and cartoonish and Infamous. While I think there's plenty of exaggeration and superpowers there, it brought a much more realistic tone and really changed the way we told stories. And so a big jump there. And then of course, you know, Ghost is the next leap. So the pattern there, of course, is your version one games tend to be really, really demanding on the team and on yourselves in terms of developing new skills, changing what the sort of organizational knowledge base is in order to achieve your next big goal.
So, well, let's talk about one of those evolutionary points. How did you make the decision to move from Infamous to a brand new IP like Ghost?
I think it was part of it was pretty easy. You know, the blog post I wrote on launch day, even like you could feel it was time to move on from Infamous for us. We'd been working, you know, it's crazy, but I mean, we've been working on it for 9 years, almost 10 years yeah. in Infamous. And I think creatively, super important that you put yourself in new situations. We felt it in the room. We knew that's what it was time to do. But I don't think we had any hesitation. Like we didn't think, hey, it could be a sequel to Infamous or going back to Sly. I know that'll disappoint some fans who really want us to go back to Sly, but we really felt like we needed to do something new creatively. We were ready. We had some vague ideas about, we really wanted to work big, you know, that kind of scale. And we really wanted to do something where the core loop involved melee combat, because we felt like that was something that we hadn't done. And it was a good challenge and felt like there was an opportunity there. So for that was sort of the genesis of it. And it took us a little while to find Ghost. And then, you know, there was this period of time when we were talking about, you know, various games, and Ghost emerged, and it was just this moment of clarity, I think, for all of us, where, you know, the creative directors, Jason and Nate, and myself and Chris, were all just like, there it is, you know. And it's weird because you've spent all this time, you know, looking at different ideas, but, you know, as much as it sounds like, you know, a screenwriter story, when you know, you know. And we were very certain when we found this invasion and we knew this kind of story with it we wanted to tell, it all went down in like literally like a 24-hour period where you're like, oh, there it is. Okay, well, let's take all those other ideas and clean off the desk. This is the one. And we were absolutely certain, and it really never wavered, but seems to have worked out.
Well, it absolutely did. But I want to kind of go into creative leadership a little bit, because given the size and the complexity of the game and the massive shift that you guys needed to make to create it, how do you get people on board? I mean, how do you, when you have differences of opinion on the creative team or even on the production team, how do you get buy-in? Do you have techniques that you use?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. I mean, I think that, you know, in part, we were just very fortunate, right? Because I think the vision for Ghost, like, I went back and looked at the presentation that we did to the team, you know, years ago. And if I gave that presentation today, it is so obviously the game we made. Like, the game did not drift tremendously. We do this chart. One of the ways we tried to explain it, actually, I should back up. So, you know, one of the challenges, of course, is that after I give this presentation to the team, and it's Nate, one of the creative directors, or, you know, myself or Jason or Chris, whenever any of us talks, everybody's trying to get the picture in their head of what it is this game that we're all now talking about is, but those pictures aren't all the same. And so the process of shipping that game, right, is converging everybody's vision of that game into what the game is. And often, it's not what I thought or Nate thought, it's what the game kind of showed us that it is, right? You know, you learn from the game itself where the delightful pieces are. And sometimes it's where you thought, sometimes it's really not. And that's part of the journey. But we always try to make up a chart that, for better or worse, we've called the pillars. And so we have on the left side are the three or four most important things about the game. And then the three or four, what's tier two and what's tier three and what's tier four. And, you know, tier one for this was melee combat, you know, a sprawling open world, all those things that we knew were important. And the next tier was things like, you know, a progression that took you on the narrative journey that brought you from being a samurai into being, you know, the ghost. It was, surprisingly, an anthology of side stories was more important to us actually at that point, even than the Golden Path. And we felt like that was important for this. And that whole chart, which we produced, you know, a handful of months into the project, with one exception on the fourth column, was exactly the game we made. And so I think we had the fortune on this project of clarity. We really, you know, and I don't know how to explain it, but I just feel like we really understood the game from the beginning, we understood what we were trying to make, and it was just a pursuit, a shared pursuit of that vision. And again, I don't want to present it like we did not have confusion. The story was very difficult for us to get right. You know, getting the player's voice in there and making sure that the characters all resonated. Combat was difficult. We certainly had our share of technical challenges to overcome. All of that is part of the journey, but in a weird way, it was, the project had this gift, which was that it was very clear from the beginning, I think, for most of us. And that really, really helped us.
That is impressive. I can say that my own experience is, I don't think we've ever been able to, with a new IP, reach sort of agreement as swiftly about the core elements of the game and what really matters. It usually, so kudos to you. I mean, that's...
It was, you know, I think it's one of those things, right? You know, I mean, like, you know, it's not like you can conjure it on demand, but you have to be able to recognize it when it's there. And it just, this one was very clear from the beginning what we wanted it to be. And of course we found things as we went that fit in that vision. You know, I feel like one of the things that really came as we went farther along the game was this sense of minimal is UI, the wind, all those were not in the original first 2 months inception. But they resonated so closely with the tone of the game we were trying to make, a game that was comfortable with open space and understood that we were going to be contrasting, you know, bloody violence against haikus and more meditative elements. And we knew that that was going to be part of the balance. And so these things kind of fit and they grew in that garden. And you just kind of nurture those and feed them as they go. And it really worked out well.
Well, clearly the team was passionate about the idea. I mean, I think that's what it sounds like was one of the magic elements from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And I know you've talked a lot about the cultural aspects of the game, but that's one of the aspects of this particular development that's fascinated me the most. And you're creating cultural authenticity for a game like this is something that I've wondered a lot about. You know, what were some of the things that you felt were most important and maybe unusual to create cultural authenticity for what you made?
Well, we had come up with this idea and, a really fairly clear idea of what the game would be, but we were afraid, intimidated by that particular issue. And we didn't know, could we do it? And even more important, could we convince Sony Japan that we could do it, right? Like, and that felt like an important litmus test for us was, okay, if we aren't able to convince Shu, who was actually the person we went to, that this was a good idea and that we could do this with, obviously with plenty of help, then we couldn't do it. So we actually, the pitch was not widely shared inside Sucker Punch initially. It was, you know, maybe 6 or 7 people knew about it. And we took a meeting with Shu and Scott Rohde first before just to vet this issue because we were so nervous about a Western team tackling this material. And it was on the strength of his encouragement, of Shu's encouragement, that that we would embark on this journey. And so we had sort of pre-vetted our concerns. And I think Shu encouraged us because I think his advice was very sage. As you know, Shu can be really, really helpful, really, very wise guy. And his take was, you're never really gonna fool anyone that this game, you know, was made by Western audience, you know, by a Western team, but you can surround yourself with resources, some of which are inside Sony and outside resources, to do this well. Like your goal isn't to pretend you're something you're not. Be a great version of yourselves. Like, you know, go on this journey and you can do well. And so, and it was on the strength of his support, which then turned into support from Sony Japan, which turned into, of course, you know, the consultants that we used here in the studio and in LA and around the world. All of that contributed to us tackling it. And so that's sort of the the producer in me. On the creative side, I think one of the big challenges was kind of learning how we were going to talk about it. And you know, I think we started saying, yeah, how do we do this in an authentic way? I think we actually decided fairly early that even claiming that it was authentic was wrong. That what we ought to say is, hey, we want to do this super respectfully. We want to be really curious. We want to immerse ourselves in the material and view ourselves as kind of on that lifelong learning journey. Let's view this as an opportunity to learn a ton and to share some of that learning with our customers and to bring some of these cultural and historical things to the market. Don't represent ourselves as historians. Don't represent ourselves as what we aren't. Know that we are Westerners trying to learn this material and then incorporate it respectfully into our game. So it was kind of, again, sort of that shoes advice. Be who you are, know who that is, and approach the material appropriately. So there was kind of a balance there. And we knew it was an original story, right? I mean, Khotan Khan is an invented villain, and all of those choices are to create, to make sure that no one thinks we're trying to represent the actual battle, even though it really did take place at this time. It really did take place on this particular beach. We know those things. We all know that there's plenty of creative license taken here, and we're not in any way trying to represent that that's not true.
How did you, when you were doing your research, actually separate fact from fiction?
Well, I think 800 years is a long time, and you find that the more you research here, that there it isn't even clear that there's a general agreement on details of fact. You know, there's very little that survives. There are some things that have survived that are, you know, written about this, details about ship manifests and things that happen to have survived. But a ton of it is all sort of to some degree or another murky. And you use the best historians. They're, you know, both on the Japanese, and actually there's a wonderful European historian as well who's written lots about the Mongol invasions and you know, what has happened here and what we, to the best of our knowledge, went on. And so you do that. But I think the most profound things that impacted the project aren't the history text, it's the artifacts. It's, you know, going to the museums and seeing the casings from the original, you know, bombs, if you will, the ceramic casings and the actual armor, and all of that really helps, you know, our team immerse themselves in the material, and I think shows up in the game. And so it's a combination of the things that did survive, which often are not written. They're artifacty, not, you know, texts or scrolls. Those things tend to have been lost. But overall, it's a combination of those two things.
The artifact point is a great one. I would never have thought of that. And I think for anybody who is considering creating a game that is somewhat historical or based on real cultural events that happened, it's good advice. You know, look, focus on the things that survived.
Yeah.
Those interesting artifacts. And that was actually, you know, one of my favorite parts of the game and really sort of sucked me in and made it immersive. Like, I believed I was there. Do you have any advice for any other teams that are considering creating games that are based on a specific culture or period of history?
Be curious. You know, I think that's kind of our mantra, is just be, you know, assume that, you know, your job is to go learn, right? Don't assume, you know, go over and learn and do your best. And then, you know, surround yourself with people who, you know, it's kind of interesting. There's the historical advice, and then there's just getting the cultural details right. You know, our instincts were wrong on lots of things, like, oh, everybody's going to have two names. You know, they are all going to have first and last names. No, they really aren't. Like in this period, you know, Yuna is just Yuna. She's not highborn. She's probably just going to have a first name. And you don't find those in a history text. You find those because the team, the localization team, has immersed themselves in history and they understand the culture well enough to help us. So, you know, you have to have a partnership with people in that culture. You're never going to figure this out on your own. And you have to go in with a really curious frame of mind.
That's great advice. So let's talk about just the sheer size of the game. Mm-hmm. It is massive.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously everybody knows that, right? And I'm sure you and the team know it better than anybody.
Yeah.
When you were in production, did team did they ever ask, how can we compete with larger teams that are making open world games?
You know, it's interesting. I think there was certainly a lot of conversations about scale, and scale is everything. But let's just talk about the physical dimensioning of the world, right? Like, how big is Tsushima? So we have a silhouette that we knew we were going to make, right? You know, we knew that it was going to be this shaped island, but we didn't know the scale, right? I mean, there's literally just like, you know, is that going to be 100 meters or is it going to be a kilometer? Like, who knows, right? And so one of the first things we did is we started building a scale model at different scales and just started riding the horse around, right? Trying to feel what is the right amount of scale to give us the feeling that we wanted. And, you know, if it was too small, you could sit up on a ridgeline and it would feel like both coasts on the east and west side were like right at the bottom of this hill, right? And if it was too big, you know, it would take you forever and a day to get anywhere. And so the original scaling decisions was made based on, you know, a rough approximation of the silhouette, just tried at different scales on the horse that we started to say, this is the size that it needs to be to feel right. So it was completely irrational. It was not like how many artists do we have times how many, you know, tiles will that be? And like, we totally did it entirely based on feel.
I would say that sounds pretty rational to me. I mean,
yeah, well, until you do the math and you realize how big it really is. And so then we have sort of these heart attacks about like, okay, how many miles of roads are we going to have to build to do this? And how much time does that take? And at some point there's a team of people who really worked, you know, we would call them the world team. They really worked on the ground itself. They weren't doing the foliage design. They were really working on getting the terrain, the elevations, the roadways, all of that to be right. And that team, I think, felt this more than anyone, the size of the world. And so they just developed this mantra, which is they would just sit at their desk and kind of do their affirmations like, the world is not big. It's not big. It's not big. And we even made them t-shirts. They would walk around in these t-shirts that the world is not big. Don't freak out. Like, you know, and wait, somehow. Wait,
the shirts literally said the world is not big.
That's exactly what they would walk around the office with. The world is not big. And it was just that one team. And it was, you know, I think we were had to just live in denial and do these affirmations to overcome this massive scale that we had to take on. And the team, you know, deserves so much credit for, you know, staying calm, working the problem, continue to improve the tools where we can, you know, learn from your mistakes. And it ended up working out surprisingly well, because, you know, it's not a huge team of people. And they just, you know, they always found a way to persevere and solve the next set of problems. You just got to keep solving them. They keep coming, and you got to work the next problem and the next problem, and eventually you get to a place where you can launch the game.
Well, it sounds like there were also, you mentioned tools. There were a lot of important advancements. How important was proceduralism to you building this game?
I think the two big changes were proceduralism and sculpture of terrain in the world, in the game itself. So the sculpture actually came first. So we were working on this terrain that was so large and infamous, you know, the entire earth, the entire ground was modeled either by hand or by, you know, assemblies. You'd make a rock and you might put three rocks in, but it was hand done for the entirety of the game. And you know, it's just impossible. Like, there's no way you're going to poly mesh model the entire island of Tsushima. And of course you're not going to texture it or do the growth of all the plants either, but we weren't there yet. We were just trying to solve the mesh solution. And so we had to go to an elevation-based height map system for the majority of what we did. And that was all new. And then we had to build in engine on the PlayStation tools for sculpting that height and persisting it out, because everything else was too indirect. Anything we did in Maya, and then you had to export and load to see it, the loop was just, you know, untenable there. So in the period of the development of this game, we built a series of tools that allowed the artists to use a sculpture set of tools for flattening and pulling and pushing the terrain around. And that was the first big, I think, world-related improvement. Again, not shocking for people who maybe have worked on PC games and in big tool sets, but we didn't have that tool set. And then the second part was procedural terrain and texturing, actually. They both have separate systems. And that was really a big change for us as well. Now, we'd known, and there's been some talks about what Horizon did similarly to generate their procedural, the guys at Guerrilla on Horizon used a procedural system to place some of their foliage. And obviously, we felt like we had to learn from them. So we spent some time, doing conference calls with them about how they thought about it, what did they do, and then we had to think about how it related to us and the kind of places we wanted to build. But in the end, we had a system that allowed us to create effectively expressions, which are sort of like spreadsheet expressions. This is an outgrowth of our VFX system, which also uses expressions. And it would allow you to take a particular piece of foliage, maybe a fern, and write an expression that described what kind of place this had affinity for. It liked places that were near water or near, on relatively flat ground and so forth. And, you know, all kinds of different contextual and other clues. And then the artist could attach, individual art assets to those, and then they would grow in the world. And that was an interactive thing where they could change the formulas and regrow the section and see how it would work. And if we hadn't done that, we could have never made the game. And there's like 3 million trees in the game. So we're not going to place those by hand. So, and we did the same thing for textures, for lots of textures as well, where a lot of the beaches and things kind of are automatically informed by textures, and then the artist can go in game again and add detail and enhance that procedural version of it.
That's a great explanation, and I'm sure a lot of environment artists and programmers listening to this are going to appreciate pulling back the curtain.
Yeah, I would imagine there'll be when and if there's a GDC with real presentations, I'm sure we'll let some folks show off all their super cool work. Yeah. So. Well, it was a fun project.
Well, again, speaking of just the sheer size of the game, do you think there currently is still or will be or has always been an arms race over game size? And a corollary question to that is, do you think that there's a difference between players and reviewers in terms of how they think about the size of a game?
I try pretty hard not to be a pundit on stuff. I don't know if there's an arms race. We have a game that I think, people can complete in 20, 30 hours. They seem really satisfied with that on the gold path.
I think it's a heck of a lot bigger, longer than that for me, at least. So I,
well, and that's if you're rushing the golden path.
Yeah.
And then, you have people playing 70, 80 hours to sort of play a really deep playthrough and they seem happy. So I don't know, satisfied customers feel like the thing that we care about. And I have not, personally, I'm not aware of a lot of backlash against the scope of the game. If anything, people love the immersion. And the most common meme I've seen is I'm playing slow because I want to not have it end, And so I don't think we misjudge the size, the world, and the scope of the game feels like it, at least, in this moment is reasonable. In terms of, of course, players and members of the press have different takes on games and different jobs to do when they're playing the game to evaluate it. But I don't think that's a surprise that the way players feel about games is different than the way reviewers feel about games. But I don't know. That seems like that's inherent, that there's a different relationship there.
No, I agree. And I think your answer is fantastic. I mean, it is all about making players happy, right? That's what we're trying to do in the first place. So I think it's a fantastic way to look at the, you know, size. And every game has a right size, right? So that's the one that
kind of works. And certainly if what you're looking for is 5 minutes of fun at a bus stop, there are awesome games that I have no idea how to compete in that space. There are amazing games in that space. Ours is, you know, you're sitting at home, you know, you've got the control in your hands, you're 12 feet from the screen, and you want a enjoyable, empowering, you know, perhaps relaxing time. And Ghost is our best attempt yet at addressing that need.
Yep. So moving on to sort of now looking back at things, I realize I don't ask this question enough of guests who come onto the show. And it's an obvious one, but I want to ask it. So now that you and the team have had some time after launch, what were some of the biggest lessons you learned making Ghosts?
I think it started with a really clear vision, and I think we're going to really be thirsty for that, really holding ourselves to a really high standard. Don't just start your next game because it's time to start it. Like we benefited so significantly from that clarity of that vision. And it wasn't a small idea. It was a pretty big idea. And it wasn't make everything better, right? It was this singular, clear idea of what we wanted to make. And so I think that was a really important lesson for us, that we learned the value of that level of precision at the beginning. And again, it's an elusive thing. It's, you know, it's a little, can feel a little like lightning in a bottle, but that was very valuable for us. And I think we'll learn from that. I think we also are going to take away, it's not so much a learning, that's partly both, just the value and power of continuing to invest in tools that are exactly what we need. You know, that the return on those investments is super high, and there's tons of areas that we weren't able, you know, we couldn't build every tool. So much, especially at our scale, you know, a relatively small team doing a game of this scope, tooling always has to be central to our focus. And we, even though I think we did a good job on tooling, I think in a weird way, my postmortem feedback is we should have done a better job. Like there was more room there, that we underinvested in our tooling, in a bunch of areas, you know, some areas that got, again, massive investments, and other areas we sort of, you know, made do with what we had, and we have to go back and figure that out. I think maybe the last one was how important it was to understand the tone of what we were doing. I think the biggest challenges we had were when things just didn't fit tonally with what we were trying to do. It may have been a great feature. It may have been a great mechanic. It may have been a great, beautiful piece of art, but it just didn't fit. It was maybe too gamey. It was maybe too funny, whatever it was, being really accountable to trying to stay on tone. Maybe it was, you know, the way the dialogue was written. So much of it was about trying to find and maintain a sharp idea of what the tone of the game was, really helped us, I think, a lot. I'll add one final one, which was, I think the best changes we made along the way were taking things out of the game. I think whether it was small things, lines of dialogue that were getting in the way of a moment, I think that we were, some of our very best changes were taking just, it'll work without it. Trust the player. It will work. That you don't need to show them exactly how this is going to work. It'll work in time. Give the player space to explore. And so being willing to take stuff out of the game was a really big part of, I think, making Ghosts what it was.
That's a wonderful learning for every team, right? I think we all struggle with that. I know that as somebody who also makes games, large scale games, right. the tendency is to just shove more stuff in there, right? Yep. And so having the discipline to cut and to not make it feel like a cut, right? It by cutting, you're making the game better. It's a mind shift. It's hard to get into that.
And you know, these are big games. You work on big games too, where, you know, it's, you know, you got to have everything, right? You have to have a great story and great missions and great side missions and great progression and great collectibles. And so it is easy to get overwhelmed by how much you're trying to put in and have that clarity to take some stuff out because it makes the game better. And I think if you're a writer, this is a familiar thing, right? It's the editing process that actually sharpens your work. If you're a coder, it's often when you remove features, you look at the success Apple has with their products. Often it's by removing features. So it is important to think about that as part of your creative loop.
You mentioned postmortems, and I imagine just about every single developer today does postmortems. And selfishly, you know, I'm always looking for a way to make them more sticky, because I think that when I talk to Insomniacs, the assumption is we do them, but then we don't necessarily enforce them because we're so busy on the next production, we kind of forget about the things we talked about. Have you found a way to make postmortems really stick?
I don't think we have any secret there. One of the things we did is we actually went back and looked at the postmortem from Second Son recently. So here you are 6 years later. Did you succeed against the things that were in that postmortem? Because it's humbling to see the things you didn't, right? But the good news is that I actually felt like we did a pretty good job. I mean, certainly, you know, 2/3 of it, I think we did a pretty good job with, and 1/3 of it, we kind of screwed up. And that's okay. I mean, like, again, the goal here isn't perfection. The goal is, it's a self-improvement journey, right? It's a, there's, I don't want to get into the specific, oh, well, we didn't do this because it's just important that a substantial amount of it actually did improve. And that seems like the important takeaway. And it's energizing for me, because it says, okay, this process can yield meaningful change. I don't think we have a, it's not like we, you know, put it on a, on in the kitchen, put it up or do something to make it stick. I think maybe I think another thing we do is we try not to let postmortems turn into a laundry list of 1,000 things. So in the same way, it's important to know what you're going to subtract. Let's make it a tractable list, right? Let's make it a list of things we actually think we could get done. I understand that we made 10,000 mistakes, but let's pick the 6 that we're really going to fix. And I think we maybe have a better chance at that if the more that we narrow down what we're going to fix, not because those other, you know, 900 ideas didn't happen or aren't important, but because we can't do everything. And if we lose our focus, then we'll end up in a situation where we didn't change. So
agreed. I mean, we can only fit so many things in our heads, right? Especially when we're talking about a new game. So that's a great philosophy. So I want to turn a little bit to just culture in general. And we talked about culture in the game, right? But you know, this year has been an unusual year, to say the least.
Yeah.
And do you think that the social discourse we've seen, especially here in the United States, is going to affect or is affecting game dev culture?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think we've been, you know, all, you use these moments to reflect on, again, where can you be better? Just like the postmortem, you're sort of doing a postmortem of your culture, right? Are you doing as well as you want? And what are the things you're going to try and change? And, you know, prior focuses, you know, you might decide that you want to focus on really developing young talent and bringing in a diverse set of people to enrich the breadth of your studio. And those are important decisions about how you're going to continue to grow and sustain your culture. It's just for us a chance to sort of dwell on the product isn't the only thing that matters. The culture of the company matters. The journey that employees have while they're part of our company really matters. And so we have to be great at lots of things. And one of them is being a place where people feel welcome and empowered to do great work.
I agree with you. And that seems to be constantly evolving though too, given sure. how our society is evolving faster than ever.
Sure.
And I also really appreciate the fact that you're mentioning culture and production. I don't feel like a decade ago we would have been saying exactly the same thing, or at least giving both the same weight. And what I see right. happening around us and in our companies is that we are shifting more focus than ever before onto just specifically onto culture, even though culture always, you know, has always existed and has sort of in some ways been organic in our companies. Okay, well, thank you for that. I could talk about culture all day, but I don't want to. I do want to. How's that? Because it's incredibly important to us. But one thing I do want to ask, the last thing I want to ask on the culture front is,
sure.
are there things that you think our industry does well in terms of culture, but just doesn't really emerge very often, given that, you know, I think given the nature of who we are as developers, we tend to focus on what's wrong, right? Every single day we're looking for bugs in our game. We're looking for problems with production. And I think the same is true when we're analyzing our own cultures. But what are some of the things that we've actually done right as an industry?
You asked me earlier about the press and the fans, and I always feel like my job isn't to be a pundit. So, you know, I can tell you what I appreciate that we've had the opportunity to do. And I think one of the things that's been awesome for Sucker Punch as a studio has been that it's been a place where so many people from so many places have come together. You know, whenever I talk to other local businesses here in Bellevue, they are literally shocked by the percentage of people that we recruit and bring into our team that are from outside the state, that are from outside the United States, that we bring in so many people from so many places to, you know, to this studio here in Bellevue. And you sit at the Chamber of Commerce and, you know, most of those businesses, literally everybody is hired from within, you know, a 30-mile radius. And it's just not the case for us. And so I think it's great for our company that we're bringing this, you know, wide range of people together, but also I think it's great for our city. And I think it's, the having game companies in your community, I think enriches the community significantly. So, that's at least, my experience when I speak to those other business heads, a really profound difference between our work, and what the majority of the other local businesses do.
That's a great statement. I haven't heard anybody say that before about how game developers enrich the communities they're in. I think that's wonderful. It's true. We bring in a very culturally diverse array of folks, and we also are doing things that are very, very different than the folks who are right down the street from us. So that's cool. So I usually end by asking just for general advice that you can give to people who are interested in getting into the industry. But you know, this week, I talked to a couple of great guys who have started up a new independent development team.
Okay.
Their goal is to make big console games. And they're currently in the process of securing a publishing deal for their first game. And I told them I was going to be talking to you this week.
Okay.
And they told me how much they love Ghost, and then shared that they would really like to get some nuggets from you specifically.
Okay.
What to do today, not 20 years ago or 10 years ago, when it comes to starting up a dev. So if you had to nail, give them three very specific pieces of advice for building an independent developer or a developer that's making console games, what would it be?
And you want me to focus this on people who are legit startups, right?
Legit startups.
Okay. So the first one is that, these are from my experience. I did not have an MBA. I did not have any formal business training. I'd never run a business. So the three things to learn. So the first one is your company is much more than the people who work for you. You're going to have a banker. You're going to have an insurance agent. You're going to have an attorney. You're going to have security people in the building that your office is in. Those are all part of what your company is. And you should make sure that you're investing in your relationships with them, because there's going to be a day where that banker is going to be able to help you through something, and where the insurance agent is going to be there for you, and your lawyer is going to be there for you. All those people are part of your team. And so if you think of it as just the people who have a business card that has your company name, you're kind of thinking about it wrong. And so that was a big help for us early, especially in the first 3-4 years. It was so valuable. I think the second is that, you know, we made what you just described as a big console game, right? But it took us 20 odd years to get to the point where we can do this. And it was, you know, at times incredibly difficult, even with all of that experience, to do this. So I think the second piece of advice would be, you got to pick the right sized project, that you have to, you know, we would, one of our mantras when we were starting was, I want to compete, put our company on a terrain that is favorable for us. So to give you the, I talked earlier about that Abe's Odyssey moment, and we knew that we couldn't produce that. Like, and it's not enough to want to produce it. We just didn't have the resources, the skills, the money to produce cutscenes like we're in Abe's Odyssey. And what you see that came out in our Sly series are these graphic cutscenes, right? Something we used throughout almost all of our work. And that was a direct reflection on Abe's Odyssey, actually. And it said, well, okay, we can't play the game that they're playing. We can't do that. That's not our skill set. So how do we change the problem that they're solving into a new problem that fits us? We would call this moving the goalposts. Like, okay, we can't play on that field. What about a different field? And so we changed it. And our theory of the case there was, well, what if the cutscenes were more stylized than the game instead of, you know, more realistic? Everybody was making cutscenes, and your cutscenes was the most realistic thing. What if we went the other direction? And we found for us a solution that we could support. We could do these highly graphic cutscenes, which you may remember. And that was our answer to the question. So it was incumbent on us not to try to go head to head, nose to nose with the whatever the best of the industry was, because we weren't capable of that. So knowing our limitations and saying, hey, we're going to intentionally avoid trying to go head to head on those was an important part of our business strategy. And now only, you know, 20 odd years later, you can start to say, hey, we're going to actually try and play head to head. But even still, you know, you look at the work that Naughty Dog does on their cinematics, and, you know, is that really the most important thing for us to improve on, or should we work on our melee combat? Where should we spend our resources? These decisions, I think, are incredibly important when you're small, you know, when you're playing with less. And I think the third thing I would say that is, it reflects on our history, which is the single most important relationship you'll have externally is your publishing relationship. And you should make that decision based on the people that are there, not your tendency will be to choose the best deal terms. And the thing that will make or break your company is the people that are behind that deal. And so, you know, getting an extra 5% or whatever it is that some company is promising you isn't worth a hill of beans if that relationship isn't a stable, productive, mutually beneficial relationship. And we have had the luxury of being with Sony for so long. And as have, you know, you now are back, you know, fully in the Sony fold. And the people that I'm talking about and that you're nodding, you know exactly what I'm saying and you know why I'm saying it, because it's such an important part of our success is that we've had a productive relationship with our publisher.
That is excellent advice. I wish somebody had been able to tell me that 25 years ago.
Well, you know, it does take time to learn those lessons. So
yeah. Brian, thank you so much for taking the time, and congratulations again on an amazing game.
Thank you, Ted.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.